Briefs. Call the final case of the day, Keller v. Summit, 11-12-21. Mr. Gibbons?
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is Phil Gibbons. I represent the appellant, Susan Keller. This case involves an employee who worked as a sewing shop manager for a small manufacturing company in northern Indiana. The company is called Summit Seating. It makes seats for buses, trucks, and vans. Ms. Keller was paid hourly, and she made between $12 and $14 an hour during her tenure with the company for about 8 years. It's an off-the-clock case. It arises under the Fair Labor Standards Act and Indiana state law.
You know, it was kind of odd in this case that she requested her overtime pay for extra work so late. I mean, so much time had passed.
Your Honor, my practice is primarily overtime cases, and in the majority of the cases, when someone contacts me, a lot of times they don't even realize they're entitled to the extra pay. They think they're a good employee. They get there early. They stay later. We've seen a rise in these types of cases from in off-the-clock cases from companies as large as Walmart that have
it's the first time, though, counsel, for me, and maybe you can cite me some cases where the plaintiff can't point to anything or anyone from the company telling her that she had to be in to perform certain duties before the regular start time.
I'm not sure if I have a case on point, but I think if we look at the facts and her job duties, her job duty as the supervisor was to make sure that the employees got their work done on time. She was given a key to get there early.
Or to open the door.
Well, to open the door, but she was scheduled to start the same time as her subordinate employees. But if she spent the time gathering their materials, going over the production schedules, and then laying out their work at their workstations, they'd be sitting there doing nothing.
But she could have done that at the end of the day.
I suppose she could have, but it was part of her job duty.
And she was paid for overtime at the end of the day.
According to the law, she should be paid overtime if she sought pre-approval.
Well, then I guess the question is, she chose to do it before the start of the day. She could have asked for additional compensation because she needed more time at the end of the day, and she never pursued that.
I think you're right, Your Honor, but the question becomes whose duty is it? The employer has a non-delegable duty to, one, control its workplace, and, two, to keep accurate records of the time worked by its employees. And what you have here is you have an employer that we have time cards in this case, so there's no dispute that she's arriving early, and significantly early. We have the vice president of the company, Sue Fink, who submits an affidavit saying she maintains the time cards. She also provides the payroll records. Her explanation in the affidavit as to why Ms. Keller didn't get paid is, one, she never asked to be paid, and, two, she didn't receive pre-approval. But that's, again, blaming the employee. The case is, when we talk about the knowledge of an employer, it puts the burden on the employer to use reasonable diligence to know what's going on in the workplace. It's not enough to simply say, I arrived a couple hours later than this employee, therefore I didn't know the employee was working. Again, backtrack in this case, like many employment cases, the defendant moved for summary judgment. And the defendant set forth two grounds upon which it claimed summary judgment was appropriate. The first is this issue of knowledge, whether the employer knew or should have known that Ms. Keller was performing the work. And the second is that the work that was performed by Ms. Keller was not compensable under what's called the de minimis doctrine. Parties briefed both of these issues. The defendant's reply brief addressed both these issues. When the court granted summary judgment, the court granted the summary judgment on a completely different issue. It granted summary judgment on an exception that's found in the Portal to Portal Act of 1947.
Not really a completely different issue, though. It's certainly closely related. In fact, courts often confuse the two when they talk about them.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, we've got, and I didn't cite this case law because I'm not sure it's right, but there's district courts out of Wisconsin that actually hold that the burden of proof on this exception is on the defendant. I don't think that's right when you look at some of the other cases, so I wasn't trying to bring that up. But
hence the confusion. That's what I mean. The factual scenarios are very, very similar when you see those cases discussed. I guess what I had trouble seeing even after reply brief is what additional facts you would have put in on the portal issue versus the issue of when she started and what work she was doing.
Well, I think there's a very important fact that would have come up in a whole doctrine now, the continuous workday doctrine. That's typically addressed when you're talking about the Portal to Portal Act. The other difference, the
but what would the facts have been that were the additional facts?
The additional facts are what she testified she did during that time in the morning. And when you look at the Portal to Portal Act, and this is why
it
is.
But she did testify to that, and you did put in evidence as to what she did in the morning.
Correct. And the judge, what the judge did in the district court, is he rejected that testimony rather than construing it in the light most favorable to Ms. Keller.
But that's not really an issue of prejudice. That's an issue of whether the judge properly applied the facts that were before him properly.
Well, had he viewed the facts in the most favorable to Ms. Keller, what the facts would have shown is that one of the things she did prior to the start of her shift every day was that she gathered, she reviewed the production schedules, and she set out all the work for her subordinate employees. When you look at the Portal to Portal Act, and again, this is why it is different than the de minimis doctrine, you have to go and you have to figure out first what are the principal job activities of the employee. The court didn't look at that. What happens with the Portal to Portal Act is if an employee performs one of his or her principal job duties, that triggers what's called the continuous workday. The continuous workday is the doctrine that says you start getting paid when you perform your first principal job duty of the day.
But every case I've seen, it's where the employer has said this is you need to do this by a certain time, and then they take a coffee break. That's what we're talking about. Here, there's no evidence that the employer required, that this be done at the beginning of the day versus at the end of the day. That's the factual distinction. I'm having trouble thinking of a case or frankly, finding a case that addresses that.
Well, I think if we look at her testimony, some of the things arguably, I guess, could have been done at the end of the day. But I think she also testified that oftentimes there were production schedule changes in the morning. She said even when she would review schedules at the end of the day, there were always things that needed to be done first thing in the morning when she got there, and it was just part of her job. But I think there is a significant difference between the de minimis doctrine and the Portal to Portal Act because the analysis, the facts you may be looking at are the same. What are you doing prior to the start of your work day? But the analysis is very different. And as I stated before, by rejecting her deposition testimony, which described the work that she was performing, the district court essentially found that she performed no work before the start of the day. And as I said, had they credited her testimony, we would have seen that she did begin her day by doing principal activities, which would have then triggered the continuous work day. The difficulty for me is we're talking about all this now, but it was never raised by the defendant at summary judgment. So I never had the opportunity to brief what the evidence we're talking about because it really came out of the blue. There were two issues that were briefed, two grounds for summary judgment, and the court simply, sua sponte, raised this issue on its own, and we're left with what we're doing now, talking about what evidence would you have entered had you had the opportunity, as opposed to what we addressed at summary judgment.
You want to save some time?
I would like to.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Putt.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Christopher Putt on behalf of Summit Seating, Incorporated. Many of the same facts, I think, are all in agreement here, that this is a small company from northern Indiana, the Elkhart area. It's owned by Ray and Sue Fink, husband and wife. At the time in question, there were between 10 and 18 employees here, and Susan Keller, the plaintiff, and her sister, May Spice, were two of the managers. They were supervisors put in place by Ray and Sue Fink.
Well, once Summit realized that Keller was clocking in early, why didn't anybody ask her what she was doing? And isn't there some obligation of Summit to affirmatively take some steps to prevent her from doing overtime if they don't want the work done?
Well, as counsel pointed out, there is a non-delegable duty, indeed. But Summit did take steps. They put into place a policy that said if you want to work overtime, you need pre-approval. There's also evidence in the record.
Right, but I assume somebody was checking her time cards, and they saw that she had more hours, and there was no pre-approval.
Yes, somebody was looking at her time card and processing it, but there was a there was a practice among the employees there, as Ray Fink testified or set forth in his affidavit that was attached to our motion for summary judgment, that many of the other employees were showing up early and having coffee and socializing. What they wanted to do is they liked to clock in as they walked in through the door because the time clock was there. Then they would walk over and have some coffee, and because they didn't want to walk back over to the door, they just clocked in when they came in and began their work promptly at 5. That was the impression that the Finks were under.
And then there were people clocking in as early as she was, up to 25 minutes early or 45 minutes early?
Certainly May Spice was, because she arrived in before her sister May only about 18% of the time over 3 years. And her sister May set forth in her affidavit that, yes, she came in early and socialized and drank coffee. That's the reason why they didn't take further steps beyond the policy. That combined with the...
What about the argument that the plaintiff did need to come in the morning, as she testified, at least on some occasions, because the work schedule changed, the production schedule was changing after she would have left that evening?
Your Honor, I think you rightly pointed out that she could have picked it up at the end for the most part.
Plaintiff is saying, and she testified, and as far as I know, that's correct, that there were instances where she couldn't have completed that work at night, and she needed to come in early before the rest of the crew was there in order to complete it.
The undisputed evidence is not only was she never required to show up or requested to show up to perform that work prior to the start of the shift, there was no expectation that she would be ready to start the shift. Susan Keller herself said, there were times that, first of all, she said, I always showed up a half an hour early, and then later said, sometimes I showed up late. Sometimes I showed up right on time. And when I showed up right on time, I did the work. But I didn't like to do it starting at 5 because it was kind of a hassle, and I had to kind of rush. And so she did it for her own convenience ahead of time. And in those instances when she did show up right on time, and I think you probably saw the graph in our brief or the summary of the different time cards, when she showed up at 5 or 4:55 or 5:06, nobody reprimanded her for that.
That's because they weren't paying her till 5. I don't know how they'd reprimand her.
Well, sure. But there was no requirement, nor is there any evidence whatsoever that production had to start straight at 5. And the updated production schedules had to be done right at 5. She said, in her own words, she did it for her own convenience because it was a hassle otherwise. But I think to the extent that there were instances where production schedules would change, that was few and far between. But even if it did, she could have had them do other work, and she could have adjusted the production schedules when she walked in at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I think she probably did that.
In the process of turning on this compressor, was it just a switch?
Yes.
Or it didn't take a period of time to heat up or anything like that?
No.
So that it could function?
I think that those, we didn't get into the minutiae at summary judgment nor here because I didn't want to dissect it, but things like unlocking the door and turning on the lights and maybe flipping a switch on the compressor before you clock in, those are very much the preliminary, or not preliminary activities, those are very much the walking to your workstation type of activities that the Portal Act would exclude anyway. Small things. So, the key factor that the court, whether it's the Portal Act or whether it's the knowledge defense that we raised in summary judgment, the key factor that the court focused upon was that she did it for her own convenience. This was a hassle to her. She, and despite the fact that she had regular meetings and she was somebody who knew of the prohibition against overtime without permission, and she, in fact, helped administer others' paychecks, her subordinates, when they had errors in pay and referred them on to Sue Fink. And despite the fact that she had regular weekly scheduled production meetings with her supervisors, she didn't raise this until after she voluntarily resigned her employment and after she was ordered to repay some.
Why did she get unemployment compensation?
That's a good question. And I don't exactly know the reason, but I do know that she applied for unemployment. She was awarded unemployment by the Indiana.
And she had to pay back $5,000 something.
$5,800. We appealed it and succeeded on appeal, so she had to repay it.
It was after that decision to repay that she claimed entitlement to this overtime pay.
Correct. It is. So it's, that's the central focus.
It wouldn't be consistent with the case law to say that her failure to come forward while she worked bars her from making this claim now, would it?
When you look at those cases, it's always a factual issue, and you've got to consider the circumstances of each case. But given the fact that she was very much aware of, of the standard, of the policy in place, and given the fact that, for example, when she came in late or forgot to punch in, she would write in not the time she claims to have started working, but the time her shift started, and she consistently did that for 3 years.
Well, but that was the policy. They weren't going to pay him until 5 a.m. That just reflects that she was aware that was their policy, not, I mean, that would be true for all of these FLSA cases. They all were following the company policy. The problem was in some circumstances the policy wasn't consistent with the law.
Respectfully, it wasn't the policy. The policy was, if you would like to work overtime, come and see us. And she didn't do that. And she was in a position that she knew, because she was involved with these production meetings and scheduling meetings, that she should have been able to say, hey, Ray, and
was anyone paid overtime for pre-5 a.m. work?
Not that I'm aware of, because there was no work going on pre-5 a.m.
The plaintiff's case.
After the plaintiff's case. And frankly, of all the employees I've talked to and that we've submitted affidavits for, Ms. Keller is the only one that has claimed she did any work prior to the start of her shift. Her sister said, I didn't do work prior to the shift either. So that's what we're stuck with. But no, nobody else has been paid. I think that, Your Honor, you rightly pointed out that there's been no allegation, even if the Portal to Portal Act wasn't raised, and we believe it was, but even if it wasn't, the analysis isn't necessarily the same as the de minimis doctrine, but it is very similar to the knowledge defense that was extensively briefed, because under the Portal to Portal Act, you have to show that you did something to benefit the employer and that the employer consented or knew about it. And we extensively briefed that, and Ms. Keller has brought forth no additional facts, as you rightly point out, to say what would have changed factually. So the court had the entire factual record making. This legal issue about the continuous workday doctrine, non-issue, I think I said in the brief, because the court made a determination when the principal activities. And the continuous workday doctrine begins at the start of the principal activity. From the first one to the last principal activity of the day, you get paid for everything in between. And that's what the IBP Alvarez case was all about. They had to take a shower and put on some protective gear and then walk to pay him for that, because that's a continuous workday. This is outside the continuous workday.
Well, except they're saying plaintiff claims she's doing the key work for the company during that time frame.
She might have been doing work that was similar in nature to what she would have done had she been paid, but there are cases cited in the brief that talk about that. Even if that's the case, if you do it on your own time, if you do it outside of the normal borders of the workday, if you're doing it for your own convenience, it's uncontroverted again. She admitted she did it for her own convenience. Then it's not work. It's not compensable work, at least.
It is work, but it's not compensable.
Sure, and there's a point of that made in the brief that we conceded at summary judgment that some work might have been done, but we never conceded compensable work might have been expenses such as that. So, yeah, that's if you go back and look at what she said, this was always done for her convenience, never at anybody else's. And that's the issue. In terms of there's a credibility issue. I see I'm out of time, so unless there's any other questions, I'll conclude.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Putt. Mr. Gibbons, how much time does he have? 1 minute, Mr. Gibbons.
you. I think that there's a couple of facts that need to be cleared up. The idea that unlocking the door, turning on the compressor, all those things were done before she ever clocked in. We've never really focused on whether they should be compensable or not. We've always looked at the time she clocked in, and the record's clear from her testimony. She arrived first. She did those things, but it was even before she even clocked in. The additional minutes to collect money from on. One of the issues that's been difficult from the plaintiff's side in this case is this stipulation in the summary judgment brief that for purposes of summary judgment, the defendant agreed that she performed work before the shift. Not only did the defendant agree to that, but they cited the Supreme Court's definition out of Alvarez, which is that it's physical or mental exertion that's controlled or required by the employer and pursued by the benefit of the employer. So we've got this stipulation when they file for summary judgment. They open their brief that way. And this entire case has now become, well, we didn't really mean that.
Well, they're saying they did it for convenience, that she chose to do it before clocking in or before getting compensated. That was her choice. It was, and she admitted that it was her choice.
When I look at cases about for the convenience, it's typically not the principal job duties. It's not I came in at midnight to do my job, you know, the very job that I do. It's these activities that are, you know, the true socializing, coming in before work and you know, chatting with your coworkers until the bell goes off and then you go to work. That's not her testimony. Her testimony is that once she clocked in, now arguably the first thing that she described she did, which is turning on the coffee for her coworkers, that's probably not a compensable duty. And she testified that took approximately 5 minutes. But after that, that's when she said the first thing she then did was went and got the production schedule for the day, gathered the materials that her subordinate employees needed, and went and laid those out for the employees so it would be ready when they arrived. How that could be for her convenience, I mean, it's the question of, I have 7 other employees who are going to be sitting around waiting for me to do this if I come in and start my day at the same time my subordinate employees do. Or, I mean, I guess to me that would be for the convenience of the company. To improve efficiency, and as a manager, I think that's what your job is. And if she's given that ability to determine when to do that, it doesn't then somehow become on her time and time she shouldn't be paid for. If the company wants to pay her as a manager and make her salaried and not pay her for additional time she spends making sure that her job duties are fulfilled as a supervisor, they can pay her on a salary basis. They chose to pay her hourly, and therefore they had an obligation to track her time properly and make sure she was being paid for the time that she worked.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your fine arguments and briefs. We'll take the case under advisement. Court will stand in recess until next week. Thank you.